I call the Health and Social Services Committee to order at about 1:33 p.m. on Wednesday, March 22, 2017. We are meeting today in room 205 of the Capitol Building. Please silence your cell phones out of courtesy. Present are committee members, Senator Giesel, and myself, Senator Von Imhoff. Senator Wilson is excused. I hope that Michiki and Bagage, I believe that they will be here. Senators will be here shortly. Today, we will hear a brief departmental overview by Ms. Christy Lawton, the Division Director for the Alaska Department of Health and Social Services, Office of Children Services. Director Lawton will also take questions relating to Monday's presentation by the Alaska Citizens Review Panel. So, Ms. Lawton, please join us at the table. And when you start, please state your name and affiliation for the record. And I think what we'll do is I'll allow Senator Giesel and I to ask questions as we go. Okay, so whenever you're ready, thank you very much.
Good afternoon. For the record, my name is Christy Lawton. I'm the director of the Office of Children's Services. Thank you for the opportunity to come and present today. What I plan to do, given conversations about what was asked for, I'm just going to do a brief overview of some key data. I'm also going to talk about some of the workforce challenges we're having. I'm going to share some highlights of new initiatives, talk about our upcoming Child and Family Services Review, and then also address any follow-up questions from the CRP's presentation and our response to their report. So the first slide you'll see is really looking at the data over the last 10 years. There's been a lot of talk about OCS, this legislative session in particular, and I appreciate that talk because it begins to educate everybody of the challenges of child maltreatment in Alaska. And this data really reflects, as you can see, really beginning in 2011 to 2016 is when we've seen that growth really climb. And in fact, it's about a 54% increase since 2011. Four of our five geographic regions have seen significant growth. The only part of our state that hasn't seen the growth is Western Region. And conversely, as you probably know, the overall population for our state has experienced a less than 1% growth in the same period. Alaska is one of...
Excuse me. So, Senator Giesel, you have a question?
I'm sorry, Director Lawton. I missed what you just said. You said four out of the five regions have experienced significant growth. Did you say Western Region had not?
Through the chair, Senator Giesel, yes, that is what I said.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you.
Alaska is one of 35 states across the country, or 71% of states, who have reported an increase in the number of children in foster care over the last 3 years. Nationally, family stress related to the recession and to the opioid epidemic around parental substance abuse is the number two reasons, or the top two reasons, that states are articulating for that growth. So Alaska's not alone. Alaska has one of the highest per capita rates of child maltreatment in the country. Alaska's children, sadly, are 56% more likely to be abused than the national average. Alaska's rate of child abuse is 14.5, while the national rate is 9.2 per every 1,000 children. In calendar year 2016, 1 in 10 Alaska children was reported to the Office of Children's Services. So I was going to tell Senator Bachicki in the classroom that our two children share at Harborview, there's 25 kids in the classroom, so we know at least two of my daughter's friends have been reported. So it's pretty significant when you put it into terms like that. Alaska also has historically one of the highest rates of repeat maltreatment, and repeat maltreatment is really measured when we receive a report of maltreatment, we go out and assess and investigate that. If we substantiate, meaning we indicate that the abuse did occur, and then we have a subsequent report where we also substantiate within 12 months, that's considered repeat maltreatment, and that's not a good thing for children. So unfortunately, that's a very high rate in Alaska. We have been making some significant efforts, which is also a part of our increase in growth, because we made some policy changes to say we need to get out to see more families so we don't keep seeing them come back again and again and again. The next slide gives you another perspective on some key data points looking at the last 5 years. On this graph, you'll see each year the total number of protective services reports, which is the report that the public makes to us. The bulk of the reports we receive, or 70%, come from reporters that are mandated by law to report to us. So they're law enforcement, education, the medical community primarily.
Okay, I'm just going to have pause here, and I just want to let the record state that Senator Begich has joined us.
Neglect is far and above the type of maltreatment we see most often, with mental injury being the second and physical abuse being the third. Of the 17,000 reports we screened in, as you can see, in 2016, that generated about 9,500 reports for an initial assessment, or also called an investigation. The 7,900 reports we didn't screen in for an investigation are simply recorded in our database, but no contact is made with the family. Next slide. So here I want to just talk a little bit about the reality of our workforce, and I know that you're familiar to some degree about this, but our workforce is primarily young. A lot of them come to us right out of school, but they don't always have social work degrees, which is the preferred education. We have people of all sorts of backgrounds. We have the bulk of our folks are women. And we unfortunately don't have the representation in ethnicity that we would like. I mean, typically you'd like to have a workforce reflect the people you serve. And we have 55% of our children are Alaska Native, but very few Alaska Native staff who work for us. The average length of training is 2 weeks. And typically, particularly in the large urban areas, new employees fresh out of training typically start in what we call an investigations or an initial assessment unit, and those are the people that are taking the reports and going out in the field and interviewing kids and families to determine if maltreatment happens. This is challenging for a number of reasons, because typically what we see is employees that start investigations, when they've been with us a little while, and openings come up in what we call family services units, which is the units where they're serving kids and families that are in foster care, so they're cases you're going to have for a longer period of time, they transfer. And so we always tend to have the greenest, most inexperienced staff in our investigations units, and they're going out and working in the field in the most isolated fashion as compared to any other job that we have. So the most inexperienced folks are out making the most important decisions around child safety, and they're going out doing those interviews largely by themselves. Sometimes there might be teachers in some of those interviews, or they might have another employee that's shadowing them, but typically they're gathering that information, doing that assessment, then they're coming back and staffing that with their supervisor. Conversely, in family services and foster care cases, you know, there's a whole array of people working with the caseworker that also has eyes on the case. There's the GALs, the attorneys, the court system. And so that just is a real challenge for us, and we have struggled to figure out how do we flip that paradigm such that we get our more experienced and seasoned staff in investigations versus family services. But it's a less desirable place to be for many reasons. It's a lot more volatile. It's a lot more crisis-driven. You can't predict your day as well as you might. You may not know that you might get that priority one assignment. You have to leave the office at 4 o'clock, so you won't know if you'll be able to pick up your child on time. So that's why it's less favorable. You also see that the average length of stay is 18 months. I know you heard on Monday Dr. Vandapalli mention that studies have shown that it takes at least 2 years for caseworkers to really learn their job. And in Alaska, as in many other states, they're simply just not staying long enough that they have ever really had a chance to get competent at their job. And the turnover obviously impacts the morale of our staff, but more importantly, it impacts the outcomes our kids and families see. We know that turnover increases the likelihood of placement disruptions, meaning we're not there to provide the kind of support for relatives and foster parents that we should. So kids are more often going to be brought to the office to say, I can't do it, find another home, that kind of thing. We also know it's going to slow down the likelihood of getting kids to permanency timely. Permanency could be reunification, or it could be adoption, it could be guardianship. But when workers turn over and they're having to prioritize what they do every day, you know, they're focusing on those things that are the most important, and that is typically going out on new investigations, ensuring child safety, and they're not getting to the kinds of activities they need to do to finalize cases for adoption or other kinds of discharge. Next slide.
Can I have a couple questions on that previous slide there? So the average length of training is 2 weeks. Have you thought about that? Is that long enough? What does that really entail? And then right underneath it, it says starts an investigation. So what's like a typical caseload? And do they start right away? How does that work?
Senator Von Imhoff, so the average length of what I would consider the formal training is about 2 weeks. Some workers get three if they're in a kind of a rural office where they're going to have to be more of a generalist. So that's the classroom training. We have a lot of great plans, written plans around onboarding employees in terms of when they come on board, before they go to the formal classroom training, and when they come back. That outlines a whole array of things that we want them to be doing in terms of understanding and learning the agency, understanding the community they're in, meeting the partners they're going to work with, understanding the services. It's a great plan, but what we know in reality is that often those plans are not fully followed, because when they come back from skills, which is when they're authorized to actually start receiving cases, if a supervisor is covering, 40 cases themselves and the two out of five workers in their unit have all the arrest, they're hard-pressed to actualize that training in the way we'd like them to. And in investigations, typically we would like to see investigators get no more than 12 new reports a month. So that would be about three new reports a week that they would be asked to go out within the time frame required, do the interviews, contact collaterals, do all the write-ups that's required so that case can be closed timely. But the number of new investigations that staff are getting now fluctuates wildly based on offices. Anchorage, it's wouldn't be a shock for a worker to potentially get 5 to 8 new reports in a week, maybe more, maybe a few less. The number of new reports on average for caseworkers are a little bit harder for us to track than the number of actually assigned families, but they're getting way more than they can possibly accomplish, which means our timeliness to initiate and assess child safety suffers.
Mm. So then the last question. So, I'm going to leave that other question for later. Okay. And then lastly, though, is what kind of support does the new young person have over the first, 6 months? I mean, do they have someone that they can turn to on a regular basis to help them in all assets? I think emotionally, as well as, looking at strategy and how to help help their different situations. What do they have for support?
Senator Von Imhoff, primarily it would be their supervisor. And typically their colleagues in their particular unit tend to be the primary support for new workers. Supervisors right now have an average of 7 to 8 workers per unit. Ideally, we would want them to have no more than 5, so they would have time to really do more quality supervision. Typically, when a worker comes back from skills, they certainly would be spending time with a supervisor, but they would also be paired up with it's usually whoever is most seasoned in the unit tends to be the person, or the person, it may not be the most seasoned, but the person the supervisor thinks is experienced enough to help do some of the in-the-field training. So the worker will spend a lot of time shadowing other caseworkers as they go out and do their work. They'll shadow them to court. And then any number of other activities that I mentioned that would be a part of the orientation and onboarding plan we have, they would also be doing. But again, that's variable depending on what's happening in their unit or their office at the time and the luxury the supervisor has to really ensure that they follow all those steps.
Any questions? Yes. Senator, did you have questions? Okay, Senator Begich.
Just on your last bullet point, the average length of stay, and do you have the ability or the opportunity to do exit interviews, and have you tried to analyze if there's a specific set of reasons or series of reasons that really leads to the higher turnover? Why don't I stay in this job?
Through the chair, Senator Begich, so we do offer the opportunity for employees to do exit surveys when they're doing their paperwork at the end. It's through an online, they get sent an email, I think, a link. It's not required, however, so that gets not done as consistently as we would like. In some regions and some offices, we know supervisors and managers personally do exit interviews, but that's not consistently followed. But when we see those surveys, and when we ask in the annual staff survey that we conduct, we typically ask questions around, if you are thinking of leaving, what are the reasons why you're thinking about leaving, to try to get at that. And what we hear most often is workload, the inability to really do the meaningful work with kids and families that they thought they came to do, There also, we can see strikingly, particularly in the exit surveys, if they've not had a good supervisor or someone that they were connected with, that can often be a driving force, because we know that good supervision and a worker that's getting that support from their supervisor will stay much longer, even under, you know, difficult circumstances with high caseloads. But if they don't have that, they don't have any ability to sort of make it through without that kind of support.
When you go visit the caseworkers on the floor, what is it that you're finding?
Senator Van Imhoff, what I'm finding is they're overwhelmed. They, by and large, are all good people that came here for the good reasons to help kids and families, and they believe in our mission and our efforts to really get kids home whenever possible. But they feel absolutely limited in terms of being able to do that successfully, because they often feel like they're chained to their desk for a lot of administrative-type tasks. And then they can't get to do the home visits, which is really the opportunity they have to have the one-on-one with the parents or one-on-one with the children and their caregivers. That research really shows that if you're not having those monthly visits with people, then the chances of the parent being successful or the child being reunified go down significantly. So it's very demoralizing, frankly.
Do you travel to the different sites then around Alaska and do the boots on the ground and do some of the home visits yourself just to kind of see what's going on?
Senator Van Imhoff, I started investigations and did family services work. I've been with the agency 19 years, so I started from the ground up, so I have that experience. I haven't in the last couple of years gone out and done some home visits, but I do get out to our field offices when I'm able to and get a chance to communicate with staff as directly as I can. I also am known to just call people up and say, how's it going, particularly when I've heard there's been an incident, but try to do it more regularly. But no, I haven't been out on an actual home visit. But the realities of me remembering when I started and the nervousness in my stomach every time I got to knock on that door that never stopped, even after I became experienced, is still fresh in my mind.
Senator Bagage?
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair. Christy, you're underscoring to me something that I've seen here from even when I worked in the division back many years ago. The frustration of retaining staff, the frustration of workload, the frustration of not doing the job you were hired to do, that kind of thing. I know that periodically the division, and then through the division, the department, and through the department, the governor, provides recommendations to the legislature for ways to alleviate these things. And they're generally not paid a whole lot of attention to, and I recognize that. But is there a more concrete list of the kinds of recommendations that you would want the legislature to do to actually hit the very specific issue of turnover and workload, other than just we've added an increment to the budget, you know, to address that? I mean, some more aggressive language, is that something you've considered doing?
Through the chair, Senator Bagage, certainly we haven't actually put that ever in writing, but I guess in my opinion, we've received a lot of support from the administration over multiple governors as well as from the legislature in terms of continuing to try to give us more resources. I think the challenge becomes is that it comes in chunks, and there hasn't been sort of an opportunity to do sort of a comprehensive look that if we really want to tackle the issue of child maltreatment in Alaska, then I think the state and the legislature has to look comprehensively at what we're doing to prevent child maltreatment primarily, so that we don't even have to knock on the door. And then in addition to prevention, in terms of the investments that really need to happen there that we have too little of now, it would be what do we need to do to turn the curve at the Office of Children's Services in terms of what level of workforce to get all the caseloads down to what would be a reasonable level that there would be no qualms about holding every single worker accountable, because they should be able to do, you know, everything on the checklist to really improve the services. But it would be comprehensive. And in my mind, you would do more on the upfront to get the caseloads down, and then you potentially could pair off, because what we know is we actually have a good number of positions that if every single position was filled and stayed filled, the caseloads would be significantly less and actually would be within reason. But because of the turnover, we just can't ever get to that ideal point. So it would be trying to almost double fill in a way to get all the caseloads down, everybody kind of working at a functioning level, retention rates would start to improve, and then really you probably could start taking some positions away because we'd have reached that point where we're not going to see the same turnover. We're still going to have turnover because the work is still very hard, but we won't see it at the rate we have if we had reduced caseloads for sure.
Just a very brief follow-up, Madam Chair. I really misspoke. I recognize that you framed it much better than I was trying to frame it. I recognize that the legislature has supported you in chunks and that the governor has, as have past governors, and I apologize for that, but wanted to be just echo what you're saying. The idea of a comprehensive review makes a lot of sense to me, much as we did at the Division of Juvenile Justice when we did our time study and we analyzed exactly what roles people had. We did a number of these various types of time studies, hour studies. I was actually involved under contract as well in doing those, and just seeing something like that that really worked with the division to develop the comprehensive approach that ensures we're doing the mission of the division. And I want to apologize to my colleagues here and to others. I wasn't trying to imply that there was no support for the division. So,
thank you. Please continue.
So this slide just is another depiction talking about the workforce, and this shows you for the last 5 years what the turnover rate has been. And this is just for protective services specialists ones and twos, which are the caseworkers that carry cases. So that's the population we pay attention to the most. You can see in FY16 we were at about 38%. And again, as I've already said, we know that caseworkers leave because they have too much work and they can't do the kind of work that they really want to do. We also know that our staff tend to suffer more from any number of health-related issues because of the secondary trauma they experience, as well as the compassion fatigue that comes with the job. There's also then, you know, their perception in terms of how much they're supported, not only in the office, but by the public at large, and how misunderstood the agency is, and sometimes caseworkers can be vilified. And then, you know, I think, in my personal opinion, is that the pay for our caseworkers is not really in line with the type of work we're asking them to do in terms of the difficulty of the work. I don't know how it ranks in social services alone, and there was an increase less than 10 years ago from a classification study. We did get a bump up, but a protective services specialist one, which is typically an entry level where they don't have any prior child welfare experience, makes about $48,000, and after that first year and they're eligible to go to a protective specialist two, it goes up to about $52,000, which is not a bad salary. But what we're asking them to do is one of the hardest jobs in the world, I think, and the pay could be better. Next slide. So I wanted to just talk about some of the good things that are happening at the agency, and I could fill the whole PowerPoint with good things because there is so many great things happening, but I just wanted to highlight a few. The first is this 5-year strategic plan to transform child welfare. In Alaska, this strategic plan was initiated when Commissioner Davidson came on board, and it was really also as a part of a recommendation from the U.S. Attorney General's commission of people that he had pulled together to really look at the issues of violence against women and children. The report is called "Ending Violence So Children Can Thrive." So if you Google that and U.S. Attorney General, you'll find it. Commissioner Davidson, in her prior life before becoming commissioner, was a representative of from Alaska that served on this commission, and they traveled across the country going to communities and talking to people about what was happening with their kids and families in terms of what they were experiencing. They traveled to Alaska, to a number of rural areas, and as a result, this comprehensive report has a whole chapter dedicated to just Alaska. It's Chapter 5. And really looks at the challenges and provides for recommendations of what the state could do. So when the commissioner came on board, we had conversations about that report and the recommendations, and one of the recommendations in there was that Alaska should form a task force to look at, you know, any number of improvements related to child maltreatment, as well as what we were doing to serve families in rural areas and comply with the Indian Child Welfare Act. After much discussion, we decided we didn't really need another task force, but what we needed was a concrete plan. And so we brought together tribal leaders from around the state and met over the course of a year, really using the information we already had at our fingertips. There's lots of reports. There's lots of data. We didn't feel like we needed to study the issue anymore. We felt like we really just needed to use the body of knowledge that was already there and also hear from tribal leaders in terms of what was happening, and particularly focusing on Alaska Natives because of the disproportionate representation they have in foster care, and the fact that despite the Indian Child Welfare Act, which is supposed to help to ensure services and better outcomes for Alaska Natives, they're still faring far worse in all outcome areas than their non-Native counterparts. So it's a population that needs additional special attention. This strategic plan you can find on our website, but really has six priorities that looks at everything from how we can provide services closer to home and in a more culturally appropriate context, instead of having a case plan for a parent that's filled with, you know, traditional Western services. You know, really it's looking at how do we tap into the Native community and culture to find traditional healers or whomever, you know, that really would be more appropriate. It also looks at how we can do more formalized and comprehensive tribal consultation. It's also looking to see, you know, where we can help tribes increase capacity for them to deliver more of the child welfare services in their own community. So it's very exciting. We've got a lot of work going on, and we're going to be keeping people updated on that. Also, in the last several years, and we really attribute to this, you know, in addition to the opioid epidemic, and just a number of the challenges Alaska faces that impact why children are maltreated, we also made some policy decisions several years ago when we started looking at our intake practices, which is, you know, when a person makes a report to us. And we spent some time evaluating that. And what we came to realize pretty clearly is that we were really screening out way more reports than we should. And we had been hearing from our partners from a number of years who were frustrated, guardian ad litem, were frustrated by the fact they'd get a petition and they'd see that there was 12 prior reports. And they'd be like, why didn't you intervene earlier? It seemed so clear to us. And so we started really looking at those reports and looking at our practices and looking at what's happening nationally. And we realized we were pretty far off the mark in terms of the proportion of reports that get screened in around the country as compared to what we're doing in Alaska. And when we went and looked at those reports that were screened out, we realized that we had a lot of training to do with our intake staff and some improvements to our policy. So we really particularly revised things to focus on the most vulnerable children, which are those in the 0 to 1 age range, but also 0 to 5, which did increase the number of reports being screened in for an assessment. And then proportionally, more kids were coming into custody because we'd actually gone out and taken a look at what's going on. But over the last couple of years, that rate of repeat maltreatment that I discussed earlier has gone down. So we're seeing less of that, which is a great thing. We're also looking at a number of ways to streamline practices. We're one of, I think, the first 12 states that have just gotten our electronic interstate child exchange system in place. It's called NICE. This is for the Interstate Compact. Yeah, the Interstate Compact for the Placement of Children. So when states are working with child welfare agencies and on either side, right now there's these lengthy paper packets that have to be completed that get mailed, and then we have to wait. This electronic system will be able to have workers enter it right on their computer, the person in the other state. It'll be right there, and so it will help to get kids placed with relatives out of state that need to go outside Alaska, and for those kids that are outside Alaska to get to relatives here more quickly. So it'll help to improve permanency, we believe. We also, as you guys are well aware, there's a lot of things with Medicaid reform and the 1115 waiver that are going to benefit our families that we're really excited about. In particular, I think the expansion to access to telehealth services will be huge in the rural areas. We spend a great deal of money traveling people to get to services for assessments and things that are not available in their community. And we also know that there'll be some more intensive services provided that might be able to actually help us keep more kids in their own home while we're helping the parent with whatever issues they're struggling with. We also have another Safe Baby Court coming online in the next fiscal year, starting in July, in Ketchikan, or I'm sorry, in Palmer, Ketchikan Safe Baby Course already happening. And this is really trying to get to those young moms that are having their first-time babies and they're struggling, and really wrapping around with more intensive services as well as more judicial oversight to help get them successful the first time, versus they lose this baby, they have another baby, and it's this sort of cycle happens if they don't get the right intensive services. So baby courts are growing around the country in terms of their use, and we're seeing a lot of good things happen with them now. Lastly, this falls in the opportunity category for sure, is the Federal Child and Family Services Review coming up in May of 2017, which I'm going to speak more about in an upcoming slide. Next slide. So in anticipation of this Child and Family Services Review in May, which I'm not supposed to call it an audit, but that's sort of what it is too, the federal government requires that we do a comprehensive assessment of what we're doing well and what we're doing wrong. This assessment, we got input from our partners, and then we also, you know, looked at all of our data. And I got hard copies for you on your desk there. It's a 100-plus page report, and you'll see we go through every item that we're measured by, and we do basically a narrative telling what the story is about that, what we think we're doing well, what we're not doing so well. And this report was submitted to our federal partners in Region 10 just yesterday. It'll be online on our website today, or if not tomorrow. And this is really cueing the federal government as well as Alaskans. Here's the story about your child welfare system. This is really the most comprehensive and honest look at what, how we see what we're doing. And people might have some disagreement, but I think generally people are going to go, yeah, that's about right. And the Region 10 is going to use that to have a better understanding, so that when they come on site in May, they can sort of take that context to the individual case records they'll be reviewing, which then will go to form our performance improvement plan. Next slide. So that Child and Family Services Review that I mentioned, so this is the second review, and I'm sorry, the third review Alaska will get. The last one was in 2008, and the one before that was in 2002, I believe. So this is, all states are going through the third round, and they have changed this review pretty significantly than the last, so it'll be interesting to see how this goes. But they're looking at items in three broad categories of safety, permanency, and well-being. So when they go on site in Ketchikan, Anchorage, and Fairbanks, there'll be federal reviewers paired with state partners that will either be state staff, or they could be tribal partners that have volunteered, or other people from the child need of aid community. Like, we have some PDs that will be reviewers, AGs that will be reviewers, and they'll be paired with a federal person. And each team will review a number of cases in those three areas, and they'll look at things related to safety, permanency, and well-being. The other thing the federal government's going to be looking at is systemic factors in terms of how does our statewide information system work, which is, we call it ORCA, the Online Resources for the Children of Alaska. It's our electronic data management system. So they'll be evaluating how that's functioning. They'll be looking at our case review system, how we do staff and foster parent training, our agency responsiveness to the community. They'll be doing stakeholder interviews with some key partners that have been identified, tribes for sure, youth and alumni. And that all will then be put together at the end of the day in a comprehensive report that probably will get, we estimate, maybe around August, after they finish the review in May. They'll provide the state with a review that ranks us and tells us where we passed and where we failed and where we've got room for improvement. And then what will happen is a negotiation period where we'll start talking about what we want to put on our program improvement plan, that they'll set benchmarks with the federal government on, in terms of if we rated 60% in this item, but it's supposed to be 95%, they'll say, well, you know, to get off this PIP, this item off the PIP, you're going to have to at least achieve 75%. And so that process, we will also be engaging stakeholders in and helping us to identify what goes on that plan and how we're going to prioritize our time and energy there. And that report will be made public, of course, when it's final as well.
So I do have a question. The second bullet point, three sites have been identified, Anchorage, Fairbanks, and Ketchikan. Remind me, how many main sites do you have across Alaska? Those are three. What are others?
24.
24. Mm-hmm. So are there, do you rotate?
Senator Von Imhoff, yes. So in 2008, Anchorage will always have to be a site because it's the largest urban area, which is one of their rules. But in 2008, Bethel was a site as well as Juneau. We have a bit of a challenge in Alaska that most other states don't have because there's a lot of rules in terms of the sample size, and most of our smaller communities don't have the sample size for it to be random when they start to pull them. And then when they have to exclude cases, they don't have enough for the actual review. So it becomes a bit of a challenge, and it took a lot of negotiating. But I think for Ketchikan, even though we say Ketchikan, they're going to be pulling cases, I believe, from Sitka and Petersburg as well to create the sample size we need to really make that third site.
So the last one you said was in 2008. This is 2017. What's the frequency of these reviews?
Senator Von Imhoff, they're supposed to be about every 5 years.
Okay. Thank you.
Next slide. So at this point, I do have a slide. The last five slides are just the five recommendations of the Citizen Review Panel, and so I could go through each one and remind you what the recommendation is and talk a little bit about what we said, or we could just go to question and answers. It's
what is your preference? Oh, what's your response?
What's that?
Would you like to continue with the presentation, or do you have questions at all?
I have no questions at this point.
Mm-hmm. Please continue. Thank you.
Okay. So the 2016 recommendations from the Citizens Review Panel, just to refresh your memory, the first one was to assign the CRP a significant role in implementation, a significant role in implementing priority areas of the Transforming Child Welfare Outcomes for Alaska Native Children. That's a strategic plan that I mentioned previously. So I think there was some confusion as to why they were not involved in the original inception in that year-long period I mentioned we were meeting with tribal leaders. I think we're probably never going to entirely agree, but we didn't include other partners and stakeholders really strategically because we felt like for what we were doing for this purpose, the people we needed to hear from were strictly tribal leaders. And those people were invited based on a number of tribal leaders that I've worked with closely for many years in child welfare to help to create who to invite, as well as Commissioner Davidson. So it wasn't because we didn't value them. We just, those initial meetings needed to be focused. But now, with the strategic plan, CRP has been an invited member of any of the work groups they can be a part of. I know they're actively participating in the community engagement group, and we are looking for opportunities in terms of how they can assist us with anything from that plan that really they could do specifically because of their, mandates and where they're best able to leverage. So that will be ongoing as we work our way through the plan. The second recommendation, next slide, was talking about our tribal-state collaboration group and considering that the group should consider that we dialogue with some of the for-profit tribal organizations. So the Tribal-State Collaboration Group is a body of state and tribal representatives that have been meeting face-to-face for almost 25 years now. We used to meet every quarter. That's been a bit pared back for financial reasons and also because we've been trying to do those at more local levels. But we did talk about this at one of our monthly calls, and the plan is to have further discussion about this at our upcoming May meeting. Right now, most of those people represent the tribal nonprofits, and tribal nonprofits obviously interact in various ways with the for-profits. I don't have a lot of experience with the for-profit tribal organizations myself, but the conversation in May will really be, should we be approaching them, and if so, who should approach them, and how would we converse to see about what the needs would be and what the ask would be. So that conversation will happen more intensively in May. The third recommendation was around this notion that the CRP should be evaluated. To look at its effectiveness, as well as the internal structure and the CRP-OCS statutory relationship. And we agree with this, but as the conversation indicated on Monday, there's a number of challenges with CRPs, and we had some good conversation in the House HES Committee yesterday, as a matter of fact, just about the statutory, what Congress's intent was, and then what the law under CAFTA actually says, it's really vague, and states across the country have really struggled with implementing CRPs. And since this was put into CAFTA back in 2005, I think it was, we've really gotten no further direction from the Administration for Children and Families. They've just left it wide open for everybody to figure out on their own. And as such, as you heard from Dr. Vandepalle, you see vast variations around the country in terms of what they're doing to meet the requirement. I think we have lots of room for improvement here, including the development of regulations, which was clearly pointed out. And yes, our department does should have created regulations and simply has not. I can't speak for prior to when I was in this role. I'm not sure how soon, since I've been in this position since 2010, at what point I became aware that that was a cap. But I think one of the challenges of why it just hasn't made it to the top of the list to get some energy behind is because of the panel's voluntary nature ebbs and flows, and I think their interaction with us and the time they have to spend with us and what they want to talk about varies. I think with Dr. Vandepalle's leadership, he has a lot of energy and interest and is able to, you know, use some of the benefits of his position at ICER, which has been beneficial. So I think we will get regulations in place, and his class did a lot of research recently and looking at what other states have done with regulations, and what we've asked, and I know Dr. Vandepalle is planning to do, is that they provide us that and with their thoughts on what good regulations would look like, so the department can use that body of knowledge so we don't have to start from scratch and really start looking at what we should put into place and go through that process so that future directors and future chairs of the CRPs don't have the same struggle that we've had.
Senator Begich has a question.
It's perhaps more of a suggestion. Maybe it's time for an RSA between the university and the division. And since Dr. Vandepalle is stepping down from the chair, he could be RSA'd over to write the regulations. You know, just a thought.
He's been there for how long?
4 years.
And on the CRP panel?
Yes, 4 years.
Okay.
Chaired it for 4 years, been on the panel for 5 years, I think.
Mm-hmm.
I don't say that as a tongue-in-cheek, Madam Chair, a tongue-in-cheek suggestion, but, you know, the university is a function of state government. Mm-hmm. They can and do have the power to RSA over, to basically send services over. And it's just a thought that it might be a nice meshing of addressing this particular mm-hmm. issue, since clearly it was one that was of interest to me.
Thank you, Senator Begich. Senator Giesel has a question.
So, taking that a step further, because he's faculty, he's required to spend 20% of his time in community service. He's stepping down, so perhaps he would be interested in community service and assisting to write those regs.
It may warrant, I think, a special situation because of his unique set of circumstances and his, 4 years he has amassed enough knowledge. We probably want to capture that while we can.
Yes, thank you. Those are both great suggestions, and we'll certainly explore that. So the next slide, recommendation 4, was suggesting that OSIA should consider building on the CRP survey effort by looking at training in more detail, potentially creating more special sections on topics of interest, and also looking if there's any other areas by which, you know, we might be able to benefit from additional surveys. We appreciate what was done with the survey. I think we sort of got there because Dr. Vandepalle comes obviously with far more knowledge and skill around research and data as a faculty of ICER than I have or that our organization even collectively has. And so there had been a lot of kind of, well, you could do this, and what about make that better? And we said, well, why don't you give it a try and see, because we just don't have the same level of expertise. So he was able to do a lot. That the downside to that is that in some ways we got some great information, but the report grew significantly such that the feedback I received from my staff is that most people weren't reading it. So we really are struck with trying to figure out a balance. If we overcomplicate it, then it's not going to be absorbed in the way we want it to be absorbed. So this year we're going back to sort of doing it the way we're doing with some of these suggestions. We're going to continue splitting out by position type, which they did, and looking at some other questions, and then trying to figure out, is there other ways maybe that we really do want to have a lot more detail, because we also do an annual survey of foster parents as well as to tribes. And we have in the past done surveys of biological parents and youth and alumni with various success. So I think we're going to continue to look at ways that we might be able to take advantage of what's offered up as resources from Dr. Vandapalli and the university. And the last recommendation was that OCS should work with the CRP to strengthen the panel's ability for public participation and to rely on it to help improve public awareness. And this is something that we definitely agree with and support. It's taken us a while to sort of wrap our brain around how we'd use the CRP for this purpose, because I think, as Dr. Vandapalli alluded to earlier, you know, the CRP in the past did have more of kind of that, a different kind of relationship. It was a little more of a gotcha, kind of a watchdog feel. And so, you know, it was them and us. And we respond to them when them ask us. But there isn't this commingling of, like, collaboration that I think Dr. Vandapalli and myself both see as beneficial for now, and the way that he views the legislative mandate, I think, a bit differently. So I think that we're continuing to figure out how to do that. We do meet regularly with them, and we're trying to not limit ourselves, because when I think about what I could give to the CRP, I'm always like, well, I know the voluntary nature of the panel and how busy they are, and so I think that sort of stifles my creativity. And what Dr. Vandapalli has said several times that is starting to sink in so that I can keep it fresh in my mind is, don't worry about what our capacity is. You tell us what your need is, and then we'll figure out, you know, if we can manage it or if we can leverage other resources. So I think there's a lot more opportunities to come for sure in terms of how we can further engage them and really use them in a robust fashion that would help in Alaska.
So we have a question here with Senator Begich.
Chair, have you ever considered a retired social worker applying and volunteering to be on the Citizens Review panel? It might provide a level of expertise that could de-escalate those moments when you described it as a panel that changes over time. It might be one way of de-escalating. I know a current employee can't serve on it, but certainly a retired employee could, or somebody who has expertise in the field. And that could have the ability to mitigate the tension elements that seem to the gotcha elements that seem to naturally emerge from these kinds of panels. Have you considered that or thought about that?
Through the chair, Senator Begich, I haven't personally, I guess, done outreach to encourage employees that are leaving to do that. And I can't recall, as I'm sitting here right now, if we have had former employees. I know we've had former employees that are fresh off from working from us that have expressed interest, but I think in some of those cases, you know, they've left maybe not under the best of circumstances. There's been concern of are they coming in the right space right now? I would be totally supportive of that, and I haven't actually thought of some of the people I know that are out there retired of calling them up and saying, hey, you should think about sitting on the CRP, but I think that's certainly something we could be doing in a more strategic fashion for sure. So that really is everything I put together today for the presentation, but I'm happy to entertain questions on any number of topics as you wish.
Yep, Senator Begich.
I would just, Christy, thank you for the presentation, and my apologies for coming a little late. I had a meeting that went over, but the idea of doing the more comprehensive review that you helped articulate better than I could, I think I'd like to help in any way with developing that kind of idea or plan with you. I suspect other members would too. I think that's necessary. We have to be sure that we really know what we need. And it goes back to your comment there at the end about Dr. Vandapalli saying to you, just tell us what you need and we can tell you whether we can do it or not. The same thing goes for any of this stuff. If we don't ask, we don't get. So maybe a more systemic way of asking so that we know what we're getting and what we are giving might be useful. So I'd really encourage you to – I can't articulate it well today, but there must be a way for us to sort of craft this or carve this so that it's useful and helpful and not just another mandate or burden put on the division. So,
if I may, Senator Begich, to the chair, I appreciate that offer, and with all the dialogue this session around OCS and the public hearings, we have been having conversations in the department of, you know, how can we use the opportunity that this conversation provides us to draw people in, you know, both the people that support and the people that maybe are less supportive or more critical, to a table to really look comprehensively. You know, let's go through this report together. Let's look at what the federal government's going to say about how well we're doing with children and families when it comes out, and let's design. So we've been talking about that, and we haven't quite come up with how that would work, but I see something like that coming together in the near future, and certainly we'd appreciate any participation from this committee.
Thank you. I want to state for the record that Senator Michicki has joined us. Thank you, Senator.
Oh, thank you, Madam Vice Chair.
So, questions? Okay, so I do have a question on slide 4. That's the one that somewhat gave me pause, simply because to me that seems to be the heart of OCS with the ground troops there. And you made a mention earlier about annual staff surveys. To what degree, to the extent, is that possible to be made public, or how can we see those? So, or does the CRP group, can they see those?
Senator Von Imhoff, we do post the results of the annual staff surveys on our website. The results from last year are there, and that's the report that the Citizens Review Panel did. I don't know if all the prior years are still on the website, but certainly if the committee was interested, I could get you like the last 5 years of those reports and send those.
Okay, I appreciate that. Mm-hmm. And then the second question that I had is, in preparation for today's presentation, I did just kind of poke around a little bit on OCS's website, and I pulled out an organization chart. And one of the things that stood out to me is that if you count from the top, which is the division director, down to the social service associates, which I believe are represented on slide 4, there's 5 layers of management in between that. And, you know, just kind of looking at other departments, it seems a little bit higher than normal. And I was just curious if you could speak on why is it set up that way, and how does communication work within 5 layers?
Senator Von Imhoff, I'm not sure which. Are you looking at the one that has at the bottom right hand that says count 31 full-time or count 27 full-time?
I actually have both in front of me right now, but the one on top is the count 31.
Okay. So this depiction is really primarily looking at our state office leadership. So what you don't see here is each of the other 5 regions that have all of the field staff are not put on here. So, for example, the division director, if you go down below me, there's the deputy director. And then she's overseeing a number of all of these social service program officers and administrators that are largely responsible for the oversight of our foster care payment and adoption subsidy programs. We also then have somebody that's overseeing everything that's happening with resource families and licensing statewide, someone that's overseeing the majority of all of our grants and contracts that are happening within our family preservation component, and so then they have staff that are working under them. If you go to the left of the paper, you see a division operations manager who's Travis Erickson. He's based in Anchorage, and he oversees, in addition to these 3 people here, he also oversees the 5 regional managers and largely the staff that report to those regional managers for each of the geographic 5 regions. So I'm not sure if that really gets at what you're asking for, but
it does, and I do appreciate it. We are asking each agency to look closely and utilize this opportunity that our fiscal environment is presenting us to look at ways to operate efficiently. And when we have slide 4, which again I think is the heart of the boots on the ground, we want to support them as much as possible. And if we have layers of mid-management, want to make sure that really helps us or hinders us? If it does hinder us, then we want to put as many resources as we can into where the people are having direct contact with families. So I appreciate you going through this organization chart. I understand that some of these layers are collapsed into one, But I just hope that you do spend time looking at how we can make it better. And I see Senator Machiki has a question.
Back to OCS ops questions instead of finance, but thank you for that, Madam Chair. So I'm wondering, and I'm going to review this. I'm sorry, I was in another meeting. I will review the meeting, and I was hoping to be here. But some of the questions I asked about, I don't see the answers to in this short presentation. Is there any correlation between, or how does the correlation work between the increase since 2012 in children in foster care versus the reduction in removals between 2015 and 2016? So slide 2 and slide 3. Have a reduction in removals from 2015 to 2016 on slide 3 from 1610 to 1356, yet we continue to increase in children in foster care.
Through the chair, Senator Machiki, I'm sorry, with the computers being down statewide, I wasn't able to print a copy in color for myself today, so it helped me see this better. But what we see has happened is, in obviously from 2012 to 15, you saw increases in the number of removals. In 2015 to 16, we really were trying to balance ourselves off. So we were still removing, but the challenge comes, these numbers, why there's still more kids in out-of-home care, is because when we were seeing these increase in removals, the back end in terms of kids being able to safely discharge reunification or adoption or guardianship slowed significantly because the crisis was focused on the front end. And when that starts to happen, people are not doing the kinds of activities that are less crisis-driven to get children exiting, and so we get this misbalance. What I can tell you right now, which is not represented here, that the data right now is showing for the first time in the last couple of years, our discharges, kids exiting, is exceeding the kids coming in. From a budget perspective, that's what we need to have happen. We need to be having kids safely and timely exit, and have those numbers be higher than the number of kids coming in so that we're not back here asking for more. So we've put a lot of effort into trying to get that slowdown that was happening at the back end fixed and being able to address the kids coming in as well as the kids that have been in foster care waiting to go home or waiting to have permanency.
Hello?
Senator Machiki.
Thank you. So I put parents that you may interact with in three categories. There are probably many more, but at the last meeting, kind of did parents that are not ready to be parents, parents that are just simply unprepared to be parents because perhaps the way they were raised maybe, and then folks that are just unfit to perhaps ever be parents. What are the proportions of those kinds of parents? And the reason I'm asking the question is, what is OCS's priority for reunification of people that have the potential to be fit parents?
Through the chair, Senator Machiki, I don't put them in those categories in my mind, but I think they certainly fit for many of our parents. There are parents that suddenly became parents by accident, mm-hmm. that hadn't been planning to do so. I don't know that we have a good sense on which parents those are all the time, but really what we see is parents that are struggling with significant substance abuse, mental health, domestic violence, those kinds of issues, as well as parents that, you know, they're the second or third generation that have been served by OCS, so they're you know, they've not been prepared, they've not had good examples. I see most of those parents, even the ones that weren't planning to be a parent, and that was very unexpected. In my experience, at least, most all of our parents truly obviously love their kids and wanted to do what's best for them. So that's the biggest group I put them in. We have a tiny, tiny, tiny percentage of parents that really I don't think should ever have been parents, nor should they ever have their children back because of the severity of what they've done. But that really is probably 2 or 3%. Mm-hmm. The rest of the parents, even though they've done some bad things to kids, that, you know, some directly bad things in terms of physical abuse or sexual abuse, or or by default through their neglect. All parents, I think, that have the ability to improve and have their situation remedied such that they could safely be a parent. Whether they're going to be parents of the year is another story, but our threshold is much lower than parent of the year. They just have to be able to be safe parents. We're not looking at whether or not they're going to be able to provide a college education or have their kid in every extracurricular activity, but can they safely parent so a child can grow up and not have additional adverse childhood experiences? So I don't know if that quite answers your question, but
it does. I mean, I just, Madam Chair, if I may, our office, our LIO is in the state building in Kenai, right? So they leave OCS and they come to see their buddy Peter up in the Senate office. So we get a lot of visits, and it's difficult being a parent of four. That can't imagine my children. I don't like being on an overnight business trip without my kids, let alone having them taken away because I don't understand why I'm unable to be a better parent, right? So I'd like to express that I hope reunification for parents with potential to be successful is absolutely always a priority. And it sounds like your answer is that it is. And I just wanted to go to the vacancy or the turnover rates. Looks like perhaps the 33% was an average over time, but that your vacancy rates or your turnover rate is significantly higher than that on an annual basis. Was there, I asked at the last meeting, was there a regional difference in... Are there parts of the state where your turnover rate is much lower, where they have a different level of support or different demographics than other parts of the state?
Through the chair, Senator Machicki, I don't have that with me today, but we do see variations. I know, for example, in Southeast Ketchikan, by and large, as during the time I've been director, has been pretty stable. They've had a very stable supervisor and a sophisticated and wonderful supervisor, which we know directly attributes to the length of stay. We know that Wasilla in the South Central region, who has the highest number of cases per worker right now than anywhere else in the state, through the efforts of the regional manager there, they actually were able to improve retention for a number of years, but in the last year and a half, it's tanked again. And people are leaving like crazy. The caseloads are up. And so we have those variables all around the state. The rural offices are really difficult for us. Ketchikan is probably an exception. And Southeast itself is quite different than any of the other geographic areas, really, I think. But, you know, take Western Region. That's Bethel, Antioch, and St. Mary's for us. We get very few local hires, and the majority of those people are coming from out of state. Alaskans, you know, out of Anchorage, Juneau, Fairbanks are not typically the people that are applying to go to those positions. We attract a lot of out-of-state people because of the you know, significant cost of living adjustments that they see. And therefore, they go, and they might be good people, and they might even have child welfare experiences, but what we see is that they're not people that are intending to stay in those communities for a long time. So they go there as a way then to work to get into an urban area and apply. And so it becomes just a huge challenge, and that obviously directly negatively impacts the turnover in those areas as well as the services to families.
Last question for now.
Senator Machicki.
So I see the reality of the workforce slide, page 4, and again, I'm sorry I missed it. I promise I will review it as soon as it's available. But and you may have covered some of this, but 2-week training period. My question is not about the training of these individuals, although I don't know how they could be emotionally prepared in 2 weeks for some of these cases. But what is the training like for? So being in supervision my entire life. Always able to connect with the guys if I once in a while put my hands on the tools as well, right? If you're at understand the operation at their level. In this case, of course, we're talking about social work. But how well are the supervisors prepared for supporting and preparing these individuals for some of the very difficult emotional work that they're about to undertake? I mean, it Are the supervisors engaged at that level? When for those that aren't in rural Alaska for a short stay, those that are in a urban setting, young people, inexperienced, lacking diversity, but have some potential and would like to be in this line of work, are the supervisors adequately prepared to adequately support the folks under them?
Through the chair, Senator Machicki, honestly, I would probably say mostly not. In Anchorage, I can tell you, having that's where I started out as a brand new caseworker of ripe old age of 24, I think I was. I was promoted within a year and a half because I was a good caseworker, and I had an OSW. And in an office like Anchorage, with the turnover we have and the opportunities that provides for promotion, good caseworkers can get promoted really quickly. And sometimes that works out really well. But we also know good caseworkers don't always make good supervisors. We do provide training for our supervisors through the same academy, through the University of Alaska Anchorage that we do our caseworkers. It's not nearly as extensive. We have, though, in the last year and a half, which has been really exciting, we've started doing coaching program, coaching supervisors to best practice, and we're getting really positive results. And this program is really more geared at how to prepare their staff, but really how to help staff think critically. And it also helps to increase the competency of the supervisors so they feel they're best equipped to provide that guidance and to really teach workers how to think for themselves, as opposed to, you know, coming into the office for 100 times a day for an answer that they should be able to start, you know, as time progresses, they should be able to start figuring out themselves. So this program, I think, is starting to give our supervisors more of those tools. We also try to embed in our training training on secondary trauma and kind of the emotional aspects that happen in terms of how we provide support to our staff, but it's not near as robust and intensive as I would like it to be and as what I think our supervisors probably need.
Thank you.
Senator Giesel.
Thank you, Madam Chair. You know, part of Senator Machicki's district used to be mine. I used to have that area, and my office was above the Office of Children's Services. And my staff there on the Kenai is a degreed social worker. And so as we wrestled with the issues that your department or your division deals with, we actually met with your folks, and it was a very gratifying visit. One of the things I emphasized to them is it's not us and you, it's all of us. It's not we and, you know, all that. We're a team. And as I look at this slide 4, I think back to my years of experience in critical care. Young nurses coming in, long hours, inexperienced, high stress, emotional, people dying, gunshot wounds, heart attacks, and the typical span of life of a critical care nurse is 2 years for those reasons. And as I listen to you, that's what I think about. Your frontline folks are critical care staff. And so as people talk about, and I don't deny that Office of Children's Services have areas that could improve. I don't deny that. But I just would suggest that perhaps we get distracted with the wrong target. Perhaps it's not the fact that Office of Children's Services needs improvement. Perhaps we need to be thinking about how our families could be stronger. In other words, prevention. Again, I guess I go back to being a nurse and prevention. We have families out there now that are not two-parent families. We have fractured families, and they're becoming more and more common. And these are the families that are commonly in crisis. And it'd be interesting to me to see how many of your families are single-parent families that you have to deal with. And those families are becoming more and more separated from the grandparents and those mothers that can teach the new mothers how to be mothers. All of these things have escalated. our communities have become more fractured, where families used to step in. If they were absent, a community would step in. Well, our communities don't step in now so much because we travel, we move so much. And so I sincerely appreciate what you do. And I think sometimes we criticize OCS when actually we should be looking to ourselves and how much we as a society can improve families and our own support for families. So just thank you for your work.
Thank you. Thank you, Senator Geisel. The one last question that I have is you briefly mentioned in your remarks a few moments ago about how Wasilla is faring and that it's been one of your more tougher areas. Do you have a particular emergency plan for Wasilla in the near future? I know you had discussed a five-year earlier in here, like a five-year strategic plan, but it seems like Wasilla sort of needs addressing sooner rather than later. What are your thoughts on that?
Senator Von Imhoff, you know, in the past, I would say in the first few years that I was in the job, what we would do when an office like Wasilla would get in particular crisis is that we would look at what was happening with our caseloads around the state. And for the first couple of years I was in the job, we were able to do this exercise that we would call workload rebalancing, which is that we would look at, you know, places that caseloads had grown and places where caseloads had risen. We'd make tough decisions about allocating, you know, positions from one region to another. And that's how we dealt with situations like that. Right now, the position we're in now is there really is no good answer. We have no place to pull from that wouldn't have negative consequences on the communities that we pull them from because of the high caseloads really everywhere. So really the only tool I have available to me is obviously excessive overtime, which people are already putting in, which just further burns them out. We also have used for the last three years, what we call a travel team. And so we have usually 5 to 6 people that are typically former OCS employees that aren't interested in being full-time permanent employees that are in this this non-perm PCN, one single non-perm PCN, and we deploy them. So they're not permanent positions. We can let them go whenever. We're more flexible about their hours, but we deploy them in places where it's got the highest urgency. We could deploy all 5 of them to work in Wasilla or to Bethel. And we've attracted people that have left us because of the flexibility this position provides. And usually when they're deployed, you know, out to Western region, for example, for 2 weeks, you know, they bank a lot in overtime because they're working nonstop while they're there for coverage purposes. So those have been the primary tools that we've had. We do try with some success in areas to bring back former employees or retired employees to work in non-perm positions to help for a period of time to get us through, you know, staffing levels. I know that Travis Erickson, the division operations manager that supervises the regional manager who sits in Wasilla, has been going out there the last couple of weeks trying to brainstorm with staff other ideas. And right now we're looking statewide to see what are the things that we could centralize further with some of our staff in state office that we can take off their plates so that workers can stop doing. But there really isn't any magic bullets that I've been able to find to come up with a plan for Wasilla, because right now, although Wasilla does have the highest number of cases, all of our offices are really hurting, and so there's really not positions to pull from.
Okay, I appreciate that. Clearly, you've put some thought into this, and you have several tools at your disposal, which is good news. I know that you had mentioned earlier when successful frontline workers show promise, they oftentimes get elevated in position. Maybe, you know, taking a page from private sector, maybe all hands on deck, and maybe some of those previously elevated folks can maybe take 1 or 2 cases as well, and everybody within the all pitch in, mm-hmm. which is I'm seeing a lot of private industries actually doing that now as they are other duties as assigned kind of comes in when you're leaving employees. So it's a variation of what you're seeing in the private sector. So, but thank you. Any other questions at all? Oh, Senator Machicki.
One more, and our vice chair today, of course, has a brilliant financial mind and always goes into that area, which I appreciate. But we have limited state resources, and unfortunately, there's been some control of PCNs that has impacted your ability to deliver. But How effective have the external partnerships been? And can we push more in that direction as well? I mean, we have, you're a partner with BBNC, and I know you are with KNITC. I assume you are with Native organizations all over the state where you have some shared jurisdiction. Can that be expanded to make your department, and I hope I don't want to use the word inefficient or ineffective, because I don't think that's the case. I think you have challenges. I think most state departments have challenges right now with funding. But how can that be expanded and become more, or to serve those local affected individuals that may be shareholders more effectively? And not only in at this stage, but in the stage that Senator Giesel talked about on developing parents prior to the delivery of a child.
Through the chair, Senator Machicki, so that's a great question. We have extensive relationships with primarily the tribal nonprofits and the tribal social services directors that are typically within those organizations. And there's some variation, but most of those tribal nonprofits all have some people that are dedicated to looking at child welfare for their organization, and they're working with the individual tribes that the tribal nonprofits compact with. So because of our intervention in Indian child welfare cases, tribes will intervene, and they have ICWA workers that will, you know, case manage kind of on their end. The challenge is that I think those organizations have various capacity issues in terms of services they can provide and staffing. So they're doing a lot with no money right now to try to help the same families. We have some tribes that we've entered into agreements with where we're able to funnel federal dollars that are to help pay for foster care to them so they can sort of operate their own child welfare programs independently. And we want to grow that, and we've got Clinkett and Haida here in Juneau, as well as Tana Chiefs Conference in Fairbanks, have those agreements, and there's other tribes that are interested in creating them. And then we have, you know, some grants that go out to tribes, but the challenge I think that we found with our partners is that they get very few dollars that tribes are given that are tied to Indian child welfare cases. The amount that tribes receive hasn't changed since the Indian Child Welfare Act was implemented in 1978. And so they're happy to do more, but their capacity, they're plagued with capacity issues just as us. They can't hire people without more money for the salaries. And while certainly communities do some of their own work out of the goodness of their hearts, as healthy communities will do, not every community has that same level of capacity. So we're always looking for those opportunities to partner so that government can play less of a role and the community or the tribe can play a larger part, and some of that is a part of the strategic plan that I spoke about earlier. So yes, we're doing more, and I think there's probably more that we can be doing, but some of that does have some limitations in terms of tribes, you know, are also taking reductions in federal funding in terms of what's been happening across the country, and so they're having to make tough decisions about services they're going to continue providing and making cutbacks too. So state government isn't the only one that's obviously suffering in today's economy.
I just wonder how much is connected to, I mean, being a fisherman, it's a lot less expensive to maintain your steering instead of eventually having to get your vessel off the rocks, right? I mean, the preventative side of things. And I think all of our social ills are connected to not breaking that cycle, from alcoholism and substance abuse to suicide and all those things where we're number one. I just feel kind of helpless that you can't assist earlier in the process as opposed to what you have to intervene in when things get serious later on.
Yes, Senator Machicki, that's a discussion that I think many of us have on an ongoing basis, and I think it's important at this juncture to have a thriving economy, jobs available for folks, and coordination between nonprofits and coordination between all sorts of agencies to see how we can create synergy and trade data and trade services and try to see if we can have a system that works together and not in silos. Mm-hmm. So, thank you. Okay. Thank you, Director. We really appreciate it. This concludes the business of the Health and Social Services Committee for today. As a reminder, the committee will not meet on Friday of this week. Next Monday, March 27th, we will hear from the governor's appointees to the State Medical Board, Mr. Doug Mertz of Juneau and Mr. Tim Olson of Anchorage. Thank you for attending today. We are adjourned at about 2:51 p.m. Thank you.